Today's pod is supported by Manscaped, the best in below-the-belt shaving. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels, and they've just launched in the UK. We've gone years without using the right tools for the job, and you can be one of the first in England to experience Manscaped's life-changing products. No more nicks or cuts. Make your testies their besties. The 7,000 RPM motor has quiet stroke technology. Not sure what that is, but it sounds good. You can get 20% off and free shipping with the code NQAT at manscaped.com. That's NQAT at manscaped.com for 20% off and free shipping.
So, slightly faded from memory now, as we have not been able to get our diaries together until Thursday night, like it was the bad old days or something. But Manchester United, you predict, I predicted a loss, you predicted a draw. Your optimism was far closer to the truth. Marcus Rashford,
it's all right,
a genuine hero of our times. Also a hero on the pitch at the end of that game.
Yes, I mean, it's actually only two defeats this season, despite all the talk of crisis. United have lost those games against Palace and Spurs, which were bad, admittedly. But
yeah, we're pretty bad.
Pretty bad. But maybe we're putting together some results. I mean, smashing everyone like Aaron Wan-Bissaka on a night in, apparently.
Who had 30 seconds into the show for Ed's first Aaron Wan-Bissaka joke? It felt like it was definitely coming pretty
early.
I
had the spread bet down already, so yeah. it can't be corruption if you're betting on your own podcast. I was not expecting, when the team sheet came out for United, to put in such a disciplined, I'd expected with that team sheet. But such a controlled performance. I mean, in the end, nearly had 50% of possession. Fashioned a good number of half chances. It's not great XG here for either side, by the way. Not too many really clear-cut chances, except from the penalty spot. But had a lot of control over the game. And David De Gea made a couple of good saves, but not 16 good saves. Uh-huh. And in the end, Neymar and Mbappe and Di Maria all ran out of steam. And United were kind of, you know, they were stronger, much stronger at the end than Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, I thought, to sort of talk about I missed a bit of the first half because I was working late that day. But every bit I saw just was like Alex Telles putting in a really good corner, or Aaron Wan-Bissaka or Axel Tuanzebe just tackling Mbappe over and over and over again. I think from an attacking perspective, the first point of praise here is for the manager, the much maligned, including by us, and no doubt will be again, because, you know, I think that's kind of inevitable, but just everything about this game, tone, tactics in starting election, very bold switch, from the three at the back to four at the back in the game at 1-1. We've criticised him for being excessively conservative. This was the opposite. He recognised the opportunity, brought Pogba on. Pogba, a massive impact, I thought, on United's fluency. And what a gamble, by the way, to play a back three with Tuanzebe and Shaw in it. Shaw, having been in awful form, I mean, he has looked good in a back three, like I've seen you say. This is partly because that he has less flexibility, and so he's less likely to make a horrific positional error. But Tuanzebe hasn't played since December against Colchester or whatever it was, and he just comes and absolutely bosses the best young striker in the world, apart from Marcus Rashford.
Yeah, and Mason Greenwood. Yeah, at least in the top three. I've seen a few takes from certain quarters which go along the lines of Are you all sorry now? Those of you who are hating on Ollie, look at what he did. You can't celebrate this win and criticize him. You know, you can't have both things. And I don't agree with those takes. Obviously, I think it's okay to take each game on its merit, and also recognize there's a long arc about where we're going as a club and as a team under Ollie. For this 90, he's obviously got it all right. Yeah. Mm. Now, when the team sheet came out, back three, it doesn't always feel great when United did that first 15 minutes. It was basically back seven with five strung out across and then two sitting in front. It's like, oh, this feels like one of those games in which United are really passive and just, PSG had loads of possession. It could be one of those games where, you know, the first piece of magic from Neymar and Mbappe and the game's over, right? It could have been that. He's gambled on building control for the first hour or so. I don't know. Maybe there's been some scouting that says PSG would run out of steam. I'm not sure that's right. They obviously didn't have a pre-season, much like United. But they've had quite a few games since then in which to warm into the campaign. But, you know, he's gambled on getting control and maybe something would come later. And the control piece coming first. And that worked. Sure. Maybe that's his best position now. I still don't think he's I don't think he's a great central defender, but with three in there, the margins and, quite narrow, the margins for him making mistakes are definitely smaller, for sure. And then you mentioned Alex Telles, who had a very promising debut, didn't make any mistakes defensively. Offensively, looks like he's got a great left peg on him, doesn't he? Which was basically the preview of his talents anyway. And then, as you say, at the right time, it was a massive gamble. It feels like a massive gamble, didn't it? To switch from a three to a four at the back, put in the extra creative midfielder and then go for the win. But in the end, he's seen like PSG running out of steam, and they really did. Like almost nothing of note created in the last 15-20 minutes of that game.
And I don't think it's wild to think that there would have been some scouting that says these lot might run out of steam because of the preseason stuff combined with, I mean, they had less of a preseason than United. And like you said last time, the French league season had started before PSG's last season finished. But they also had like loads and loads and loads of players out. And beyond the front three, they just offered so little. They just did not look like a good team at all. So for two reasons, because when you gamble in any field of life, what you're trying to do is have the odds in your favour. If you're trying to play poker, you don't know that you're going to win, but you try and get the chips in with a better hand than you're more of a percentage chance that it's a good gamble than it's a bad. Now, we've categorised Fergie over and over and over again. Almost the perfect definition of Alex Ferguson's entire career is that he's a really, really good gambler. So it doesn't always work, but it works much more often than it doesn't. The house always wins. Fergie always wins. The data points that you could say justify that big gamble in the second half were the individual performances of the defenders, the fact that Wan-Bissaka and Twanzebe in particular were clearly just absolutely bang on it. Dave, I mean, maybe you could say it's a risk to gamble that Dave will keep being good in any given game. But the last couple of games, he's looked something close to his best, actually. And then when you combine the fact that our one-on-one defending should be better than it normally has been, given what we're seeing in front of our eyes, and what a shambles PSG looked from behind the back three on, it's actually a pretty good gamble in terms of, it's not just like a one in a million shot that it worked. You know, it should have worked more times than it didn't, effectively. I don't know if that's true, but it's a theory.
Yeah. And look, anyway, the gamble paid off and United came strong. And it's taken a brilliant goal to actually win it. So although United were strong in that second period of the second half, I don't think we were smashing down the barn doors or anything. Unlike Aaron Wan-Bissaka on a Friday night, no. This is a podcast, so you can't see Paul's eyes rolling into the back of his head. Yeah. And we'll get that going again before the end of the show. Anyway, shall we talk about the goals and some of the details of the game?
Sure.
And United took the lead through Bruno, who missed his second spot kick in a row.
That was terrifying, that was. It was like the natural order of things has suddenly been, you know, when Obi-Wan feels that Alderaan's been destroyed, felt a little bit like that. Have all goalkeepers now cracked Bruno Fernandes? But no, it turns out that they have to cheat to have a chance at saving his penalties. And fortunately, the vigilant good guys at the heart of football, making sure the rules are properly applied in the fashion that we've encouraged and supported right from the beginning, noticed that Kayla Navas had taken a little hop, skip of and step of his own off the goal line.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder whether goalkeepers have to have a saved penalty retaken in order to learn the new rule. They freaked out PSG. I mean, what was the point of them surrounding the referee and complaining? I didn't quite get that. I mean, we know what this is about now. The VAR looks at it and concluded, well, in fact, the linesman first pointed it out. I think he would have called it anyway, but the VAR has, you know, all the angles plus the stop motion. It's as clear as day. The edict has gone round from on high. Everyone knows the rules now, and as nitpicky and jobs worthy as this is the rule. And you know, as Dave found to his cost the other day, so it's going to be called this way throughout the season. So.
Yeah, I like to think that the PSG, I don't know what French is for, le jeu est parti, the game's gone. I think that's what they were shouting. Bruno was then, it was very fun, like Darren Fletcher from, not our Darren Fletcher, good, get Darren Fletcher, the lead commentator on BT Sport is, I think, the worst commentator in the game. Fernandes hit exactly the same penalty the second time as the first time, and he goes, he's got it spot on this time, that's a brilliant penalty from Bruno Fernandes. Like, it's the identical penalty, and okay, he sent the keeper the wrong way this time, which is, that makes it better, but it was very funny to see him put the ball in almost exactly the same spot it just got saved and be wildly praised.
Yes,
for
I'm sure that I'm sure there is a psychological theory about, you know, focusing on outcomes here rather than inputs. Fine. Good for Bruno. I mean, you know, the advantage is massively with the attacker, and even more so now. I do wonder, like, so the average, it depends on which division you look at, but the average number of penalties scored is somewhere in the region of 8 out of 10. I do wonder whether that will go up slightly. And we're going to see more penalties, so we'll get a bigger data set. And now goalkeepers have less of an option. Maybe they'll try some different things.
So that was towards the back end of the first half, right? And then it was early in the second half. What's that, sorry?
23 minutes.
Oh, yeah, okay, there you go, right? So earlier than I thought. And United were in the ascendancy for a good period. And basically, I know I keep talking about this, but Twanzebe and Wan-Bissaka's one-on-one defending in that game was absolutely, totally and utterly elite. You know, we talked about Wan-Bissaka and the limitations, and I keep coming back to the point that he does what he does well to a level that almost no other fullback does. So we do need to talk about his exceptional strengths as well as his limitations. But the two of them were just, I mean, utterly magnificent. And Twanzebe looked like, I mean, he looks like United's best centre-back. It's very simple. I mean, it's one game and who knows. But in that game, he performed better than any United centre-back has done since, oh, I don't know, the last time he played.
Well, that's it. That's the thing. Like, every time we see him, you know, you get the feeling that he's a really classy defender, and just one that's had a career of injuries. And it's, we talked about him around this time last season, or maybe more like 18 months ago. And he spent time at Aston Villa and Fulham. Fulham, or was it just Aston Villa? Can't remember. Can't
remember. I remember him going to Aston Villa. I didn't know there was another one.
No, probably just Aston Villa. I'm blanking. Because I'm getting old or something like that. And even then, he only played about half the available minutes because of injury. And he'd had injuries at youth level as well. And he's had injuries since coming back to United. I mean, the beginning of last season, he was basically given the opportunity to stake a claim for a place and got injured very shortly afterwards. Like, not big injury, little injuries. And then he got a more serious hamstring injury in that game against Colchester in December of 19 and hadn't played since as a result. And you know, it does feel kind of now or never. It's not now or never, but it's not far off it because he's 23 in 6 weeks' time. He's no longer a kid and he's played hardly any football at the top level. For a player that good.
Yeah.
You know, who's got all the tools, the pace. I mean, he hit one crossfield pass that was about 70 yards. And I just thought, like, who else in the United team is hitting that ball?
So, yeah, Rooney.
Rooney.
Doesn't play for us anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. And he's got the other thing he's got that no one else has got, apart from Eric Bailly, is the recovery pace. And I think Maguire needs that. He really does. He needs to be the player that's attacking the ball and someone's able to recover. Otherwise, he's getting found out a lot. And that's clearly what happens.
Well, I have to say, there is a hugely natural partnership between those two as well. That's you know, that's the other thing. So then
what, Bailly and Tounsabi? Yeah, no, I agree. That's a good fit.
I just think Tounsabi's got what Maguire needs. And actually, Maguire probably could help Tounsabi too because, you know, Maguire can be so dominant in the air, not that Tounsabi's bad in the air, obviously. So United did well, snuffed out a lot of PSG chances, a couple of good saves from Dave. And then they get a corner and Anthony Martial, who had a difficult day, I think. He won the penalty. Yeah, he totally did. He won the penalty for United. But I thought United's two forwards, I mean, they obviously made extremely telling contributions in winning the penalty and then winning the game. But they both slightly struggled, I thought.
Yeah, I thought they were too far away from each other most of the time.
Yeah,
I
mean,
you know, at times Rashford's trying to play the 1-2 20 yards away from Martial with three defenders in between them. So,
Times, Rashford's trying to play a cut-through pass when he had about 40 acres to run into and shoot. It was very unfortunate.
It was odd. I mean, given the goal he scored and the quality of that finish, why he seemed to refuse to shoot earlier in the game. But anyway, yeah, so they didn't have... I mean, the two of them, fine. They made contributions, but they didn't have great games.
No,
but behind Martial, them, no one had a bad game, right? Bruno was excellent. Fred and McTominay in midfield, energy, defensive discipline, good use of the ball.
McTominay playing the first half with one contact lens.
Yes, yeah, it came out halfway through the first half, didn't it? Yeah. I mean, I wear contact lenses. Like, that's impossible. I don't know. Maybe wandered around with one eye closed or something like that. It's a truly horrible feeling. I think everyone who's got contact lenses is nodding along now because it just sends your equilibrium completely off. And we talked about Telles and his delivery. I think that's especially from set pieces. I mean, he's no Phil Jones, but
I mean, if he plays a lot of games and we've got Bruno and Telles taking the set pieces,
it's much stronger. Yeah, yeah. Wan-Bissaka doing Wan-Bissaka stuff and making tackles. They're going to keep coming. Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Even Lindelof had a good game. Maybe he just doesn't need Calamity Maguire beside him in order to play well.
Possibly. One of Martial's extremely telling contributions, unfortunately, was one heck of a near post flicked header. closed his eyes. What are you doing, Tony? Quite early in the second half. And I was a bit worried at that point because it felt like that was exactly what we didn't need to do. Like, just give them a lifeline, give them, you know, allow them to smell blood kind of thing. But actually, it wasn't like a massive onslaught followed. I mean, they did have periods where, as you'd imagine, they had periods where their fine attacking players created some promising situations. But we mostly either snuffed those out or De Gea, you know, was more than equal to the challenges. And I did think we looked more likely to score. I mean, that one which won't show on the XG map where Rashford was in acres of space, like I said, that was sort of indicative of how much joy we could have had on the counter-attack. And it came from like a very simple ball from Fernandes that I think that one, I might be thinking of a different one where we got in behind with a simple ball. So, you know, United were somewhat profligate, actually, and it was fantastic that they weren't punished for that, because Marcus Rashford, who had looked desperately short of confidence all game, in spite of having scored a really good goal at the end of the Newcastle game, suddenly found his mojo and hit a shot that made it look like he was brimming full of confidence.
Yeah, I mean, 14 chances each, which will tell you it's a fairly even game, and United craned 14 chances away from home at Parc des Princes, you know, the European Cup finalists from just a few weeks ago, it's impressive. I mean, a lot of that's about structure of the game as PSG pushed forward and the way they played with their fullbacks. United were able to break very effectively, and this wasn't parking the bus by any means. It was a very sound tactic in this particular game. 6 of 14 on target from United and 5 of 14 on target from PSG. You know, this was an even game in which the tactical battle was won by United. And,
yeah,
you know, it was interesting that Tuchel made all his five substitutions, all three of his five substitutions pretty early, and then two more as United took the lead. And Ollie didn't, he only made one until Rashford scored, and then he made two others to try and waste some time. He maybe forgot that he's got five substitutions in Europe.
But I think it was also about the way that the teams were using energy, because United had been able to, you know, their tanks were very full by the end of that game. And the one substitution he made is this thing that we have accused him of, and lots of people have accused him of, and rightly so, of not being able to substantially influence games from the touchline. But he absolutely did in this game. He won the one-on-one tactical battle with the opposition manager as much as anything else. And it is bold at 1-1 to say, yeah, we're going to roll the dice. And, you know,
turned it into a cup tie, didn't it? I mean, the amount of back and forth attacking there was in the second half of that match, or the second half of the second half of that match, was interesting. But he gambled that United would create the better chances, and that was true as well.
Yeah, and it comes back to this thing that, you know, we've talked a lot about the doom and gloom, and by the way, just after the break, we'll be talking about the finances for some extra doom and gloom fun. But United have got a team that is absolutely packed full of talent. There are problem areas, there's problems with strength of depth, and there are areas where we don't even have a really obvious good first choice, first 11 player. But the talented players in that squad are incredibly talented. And when you put a bunch of them on the pitch together, they will more often than not. That's why I think 2 weeks ago I said United are going to finish seventh or eighth or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That's why I think it was you'd said it's going to be like close to a miracle if we finish in the top four, and I just don't think it will be close to a miracle, because we have got such a high level of quality in certain key positions, and when it comes off, it really comes off. And I think that will continue to happen a lot. Like, after the Palace game, I think I said on the show, I'm not worried about our good players being rubbish in this game. Like, that is just not a worry, because that's a lack of pre-season, that's all these things. Spurs was a bit of a worry, because it felt more like a kind of collective capitulation, in a way that you don't want that mentality to be around. But this was a really good example, and they're going to have to start doing this against weaker teams. Although, to be fair, they did, for 10 minutes at least, do that against Newcastle in the previous game. So It was a good game, and it's a massive result, obviously, just in and of itself.
In terms of qualification for the round of 16 of the Champions League, sure, of course. Yeah. Going to need that income, as we'll talk about when we get onto this, that part of the show. But, yeah, of course, this was, you know, on paper, the hardest game of the this first round, and United mm-hmm. banked 3 points already. Win the home games or win two of the home games and get a couple of draws, and United will be in the round 16.
Yeah, and of course winning the home games is no mean feat. Been a while since we beat PSG at home. If we remember back to that glorious night in Paris, was in fact created by a pretty miserable night in Manchester.
So that's right.
But Marcus Rashford kind of followed that up by campaigning vociferously against our callow, feckless, selfish, class ideologue government into trying to, this wildly crazy socialist idea. Oh yeah, stop children from starving. Unfortunately, this time he was unable to influence government policy, but he will. And where he doesn't, he'll be a rallying cry around which people step in where the government should be.
Yeah. Do you know who his latest supporter is?
Nigel Farage.
Yeah. Now, when Farage is on your side as a campaigner, You're either into some dodgy territory,
yeah,
or perhaps the government need to look at this again.
Yes, I suspect they won't. But you know, like even in defeat, in terms of the I'm welling up. It's been a long day. But even in parliamentary defeat, Marcus Rashford will win out here because there will, without doubt, be children who, otherwise wouldn't have enough to eat, having enough to eat because Marcus Rashford exists. And
are you sure?
How many of us can say that, you know?
No, I have, apart from my own little people, I have not fed a hungry kid in some time. So yes, look, you know, Marcus Rashford has, achieved what many people can't with or without power, and he's used his platform for, you know, a tremendous amount of good. Have to say, I sat on the we'll take a break and we'll come back to finances, but I sat on the finance call, as I do once a quarter, or if they can be bothered to do the calls these days, and Richard Arnold was claiming credit for it, which I have to say, as much as United did some very good stuff during the lockdown, supporting the NHS, giving to food banks, doing a lot of work through the foundation, this one was on Marcus Rashford, not the
Absolutely.
Club.
Right.
And, you know, he's winning hearts and minds. I mean, the amount of schools that are having days talking about Marcus Rashford or building collages or talking about the importance of having a good lunch to education and educational outcomes is huge, you know, anecdotally based on the number of Twitter posts going around about it. Mm. You know, he is winning hearts and minds here because it really does take a stone cold heart to say, you know, and clearly we don't believe this, but if you're of the mindset, and you can still listen to our show, Broadchurch, if you're of the mindset to blame poverty on the poor, it takes a stone cold person to blame poverty on a child. Except for Tory MPs, which are definitely still doing that.
Yeah, and you know, their argument is that the thing that Rashford, and we should, in fact, sorry, we'll take a break in just a second, but there's a couple of things I did want to mention. One, there is a coordinated campaign against Marcus Rashford and his message from the Tory party, which tells, like, this is like, you know that meme where the guy comes in and goes, "Are you winning, son?" Like, Mark, you know you're winning when they are trying to do this to you. If these are your enemies, you know you're on the right side. And if this is how they're acting, you know you're on the right side of the argument. You know, Twitter celebs and whatever. And actually, when the MPs have tried to engage with Marcus Rashford, he has replied to them with an incredibly measured, incredibly, actually, like, politically centrist tone, saying, I'm not here for politics. This is not about politics. This is about an issue that should transcend politics, that we should all be able to agree on. And when they've come at him with facts, he's come back at them with facts. And when they've, like, better, more accurate, more detailed facts. And when they've come at him with evil, he's responded to it and called it out, you know. So not only what he's doing, but the way in which he's doing it. Like, he's not a credit to the club. He's a little bit of credit to the club, but there'd have to be more than one of him for you to say it's a credit to the club, you know. Like, I'm not saying they should all be doing it, but the others would all have to be doing it too. He is an unbelievable credit to himself, to his family, to the community that he's a part of. Like, he's a truly, truly, truly remarkable young man. And
yeah,
when some dirt comes out about him, as it definitely will, because you can't shake the tree in this way without them coming after you, none of that will change this. So,
no,
that, yeah,
no, that's right. Look, you know, he's pure of heart and a real giver, much like Aaron Wan-Bissaka. In the bedroom.
You're a bad person, Ed. Never let anyone tell you different. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. If you want more from the show in between shows, check us out on the socials. We are NQATpod on Instagram, Ed's at NQATpod on Twitter, and we are under our real names on Facebook at No Question About That. Okay, so we ended on a brutal note there after a heartwarming moment. Let's continue the descent into the pitfalls of the evils of capitalism and talk about United's financials. Can you break it down for the people, Ed? What is going on? Do we have any money?
No. No, we are stone cold broke. it's really interesting how they delayed and delayed and delayed this. So this is full year results, basically, for the financial year 1920. So it's to the end of June. Typically, they did give some information beyond that in the call. And this is normally at the beginning of September, and obviously we're into late October now. So they've delayed this a long time for reasons, you know. Reasons, I guess. I think they wanted to try and give some positivity. I have to say, I find the actual call a massive waste of time because they don't give any information that's not in the press release or the investor information. And no one on call asks any sensible questions. And the only people that get called to ask questions are from the big banks. So that said, so United's revenues are down more than 100 million year over year. This reflects both the impact of the pandemic and the closed stadiums and the rebate to television, as well as United being in the Europa League last season and not the Champions League. That bit actually has a bigger impact. We will see the impact of closed stadiums into this financial year as well. Cliff Beatty, the CFO, gave some details on what we think the impact of the pandemic has been. So the estimate is about £70 million to date, but with significant pain to come. So the £70 million is made up of lost broadcasting income, so broadcasting rebate, some sponsorship rebate, and predominantly no fans in the stadium. The impact on cash reserves is absolutely astounding. So more than a £250 million change in cash. Now, some of that is what we've just said in terms of lost income from stadiums. It's also a deferment on some sponsorship. So they're not paying until we get back to normal football. It's also the likely rebate to come or a withholding of TV money. The fact that United chose to make what they called accelerated payments on money owed for transfers. So they're trying to pay some of that down. I don't know why, but they are.
I wonder if I mean, I have no idea, but maybe it will
free up some room. It will free up some room down the line, potentially. They said about 120 million in this financial year on transfers. Obviously, a significant amount has already been spent. So that would suggest, don't get your hopes up for Sancho arriving next summer, folks.
In January.
Yeah.
Are we talking about that money includes next summer's transfer window?
Yes.
Because there was not a lot of overhead in what they said compared to what's been spent, right?
No.
Wow.
Yes, things can change. So a big sale might change that. Net. They did talk about net. They bigged up the fact that they claim, and I've not verified this, mainly because I couldn't be bothered, that over the last 2 years, so however many windows, the United are the biggest net spenders amongst any of the European elite clubs. Right. I think they were taking this as the financial year and not counting Chelsea's spend this summer. But we'll see, you know, I don't know. Because that's really huge.
It's really interesting that they're prepared to admit that that's the case, given that they've not built a kind of elite level, a squad that can challenge for the league.
None of the analysts care about that. They don't know. Yeah, so they don't get those kind of questions. What they try to do with these are position United as healthy, 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 but, you know, oh, these terrible things from the outside, but we're planning for it. So they've increased their revolving debt facility up to 250 million. I think that's some level of prudence because of the next thing I'll say. But also some level of panic, I think, about exactly what the cash position will be. So they also said that they don't expect fans to be back in the stadium. The government has guided them that it won't be before March 21, and even then likely to be a much reduced capacity. Which is, it can't be a surprise, honestly. I know there's a lot of people fussing about the fact that there's a concert at the Albert Hall or whatever. But when the scientific advisory group is saying no mass events, the problem is the concert at the Albert Hall, not the fact that there are no mass events over here. And I know none of us want this, right? But the knock-on effect is more people in a grave, you know, so this is really serious, as are United's finances. What else did they say? They said... The cash position is also worse because they haven't had season ticket revenues and they've had to defer sponsorship. And then they did a really interesting thing where they kind of talked about the Chevy deal, which is supposed to run out in the summer of 2021, and added an extra 6 months
for a tiny amount.
It's £11 million extra. And also an agreement that all future payments for what's left of the 18 months of the deal will be in pounds, not dollars, because the original agreement was made in dollars and the fluctuating pound-dollar rate meant there was no stability in you know, it went from 54 million at the low end to 80 million at the top end, depending on the Forex rate. So they've hedged against that. What else? Oh, yeah, they bigged up the fact that they'd got 8 new sponsorship deals. And renewed 8 existing partnerships and made a big thing about a new media rights partnership with Alibaba in China.
So I've got a question about that Chevy deal. That 11 million represents, this is a 750 million deal over 5 years, right? So what's 6 months of that? That's,
oh yeah, it's tiny. It's a sweetener. Whatever reason, they're not saying why they did that, because, you know, you could say 11 million, are they really that desperate for the cash? Well, maybe. It also might buy them a little extra time to find a new sponsor, because, and I think this is probably a big thing, denied in briefings, but I can't imagine there are too many global companies in the middle of, you know, a huge economic downturn that are looking... at, you know, laying out, you know, what are United looking for? £70-80 million a year for a shirt deal. I mean, I can't imagine that the market for that is too big right now. So they're buying themselves some extra time to go and negotiate that deal. Could mean that next season, and I know we've only just started this one, United change their shirt sponsor halfway through the season, which could be interesting. That's it. Oh, and right. The Glazers confirmed they've taken £23 million in dividends this year. £97,000 less than last year. So they took a pay cut, you know, the heroes that they are.
I just did a quick bit of maths. So 750 divided by 5, that's 150 million a year, right? So you divide that by 12 to get the monthly fee, and that's 12.5 million per month.
Yeah.
So
dollars that is. But yes.
Oh,
yes,
is that dollars? Okay. Right. So there's some, but still we're not far off. They're paying 1 month's worth more of the money to get 6 months more sponsorship, effectively.
Something like that, yeah.
And if they change sponsors in mid-seasons, that means replica shirts going
through the roof.
Real weird. Yeah. They also, of course, bragged about increased social engagement.
There was a whole piece about that. I mean, I was just waiting for it. You know, it's always the waffle up front, and then they get into the social media reach.
And what they didn't say is the percentage of positive and negative social media engagement. It doesn't matter, folks. If you at the Man United admin to say, why haven't we signed Sancho yet? You are part of the problem. You're adding to the numbers. I mean, you're part of the problem in a whole lot of different ways.
You know, like so one of the things the researchers say about, say, disinformation, especially sort of political disinformation, is that the worst thing you can do is basically amplify the thing that you disagree with.
Yeah.
And that, thinking about network effects, what you should do if you do amplify it is put out 5 times as much stuff that is the opposite of what you've just amplified. Yeah. So I don't know what the equivalent is in football, but yes, you know, suggesting that you see Ed Woodward next Tuesday is helping their brand reach, which is, you know, they claim it's like it went up from 630 odd million to 1.1 billion last time they did a survey. It's probably 10 billion or something by now, and we've exited Earth and gone interplanetary in terms of the number of followers we've got.
So we had one question come in on our Instagram messages.
Questions? We have to deal with the audience now, do we?
It's a good question. I wanted the answer. That's why I thought I'll ask you about it. Varun Kasturia said, usually we go after the financials, but right after the earning report, United stock ended the day up almost 10%. Given that it wasn't the best year financially, any idea what may have led to that? And I guess, can I just guess that it's people thought it was going to be worse? Because that's often what happens. It's like
bad news. Only 20% of United stock is publicly traded, and it's quite low volume stock. So, you know, a few trades could have an outsized effect. So I don't know whether I'd read too much into that. I mean, United stock is barely above where it was at IPO. I mean, it's a terrible investment. It is net value destroying now. I mean, it used to be just it wasn't a very good investment, and you'd be better putting your money into an index fund than into the United United shares. Now you'd be better putting your money under the mattress. It's been an awful investment, except for the Glazers, whose very, very minimal early investment has turned into this big on paper asset. They can take dividends out each year. And Ed Woodward, he's got a £4 million salary.
Unless you're thinking of a leveraged buyout, which you can't do because the shares don't have the right kind of rights you would need for that, don't buy United shares. And also, of course, like the stock market is up and down like an absolute yo-yo at the moment, which I only know because I'm tracking the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah, and most likely people are actually buying United stock as part of a portfolio in the sector as well. So, I mean, you know, it's... And the final thing, just in case we were being too rosy for you, current debt, gross debt, £525 million, and because of all that... cash at hand, going up in smoke. Just 51 million in the bank at the moment. Net debt, 474 million. 15 years after the buyout.
Amazing. And what's extraordinary about that is we've been talking about how the debt is kind of down to controllable levels, but that's the net debt, right? So when the cash reserves take a massive hit, the net debt goes right up. And since it's a massive hit to the cash reserves, that's going to move the needle on the net debt, isn't it?
It did. I mean, it's the kind of, apparently we've been asking for 18 million for Phil Jones. we'd have to sell Marcus Rashford to put a dent into that. Maybe we could. I mean, if we float him in front of Manchester City, they'd probably pay that for him. Not for the player, just for the PR value.
You take that back right now. Let's take another little quick break and come back with a little preview of the Chelsea game. Okay, two financial powerhouses going up against each other, the big net spenders. I don't know, Chelsea somehow had a 0-0 draw, which I did not think was mathematically possible anymore. But you cannot see these two teams coming up with a 0-0 draw. And the one thing that I hope beyond anything else for this game is we go the heck at them, because Chelsea have a very definite strength and a very definite weakness, and it would be good if we could exploit the one yes. rather than try and minimise the other.
Like Chelsea's last six games, they've scored 6-3, just the one, but 4 in the penalty shootout, 4-3, and then 0 against Sevilla, although that was a top quality side they're playing, obviously. So yes, with all those attacking players, they've got tremendous strength in attack, and we talked about Timo Werner on the backers content last time out. Yeah. You know, he's really coming good, and Havertz behind him, a real creative powerhouse, and whatever combination of Mason Mount, Pulisic, Ziyech, they want to play in wide areas. It's all very high quality. So, you know, they've spent a lot of money and spent it pretty well. What they didn't do, which is absolutely criminal now looking at it, is buy a central defender and a goalkeeper. Well, they bought the goalkeeper, but they haven't played him yet. So, I don't know, has he been isolating for COVID? What's the reason that Mendy is not playing? Is he not
fit?
No,
I think he played against Sevilla.
Right.
Unless I'm much mistaken, I think he played this game. I'll just quickly look that up. But
he did. You're correct. Yes.
More significantly than that, I'm pretty sure that Petr Cech was registered as potentially being able to play in goal. So while we have got three really high quality goalkeepers, Chelsea are using Petr Cech as a backup.
It's logical, you know. I mean, I'm sure it's if a crisis hits. Hopefully, it does. Not that I'd wish ill on any of their players, of course. It's going to be an interesting sort of clash. We'll see whether Maguire's back, of course, and whether he comes back into the side. And what does that mean for the shape of the side? Is he going to match up, is he going to continue the three at the back? Lampard won't play three at the back, I don't think. Or revert back to the 4-2-3-1. Does Pogba come into the side?
Would you start Pogba? I would.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, obviously, it depends. The only reason you wouldn't is if you're going for a counter attacking strategy
good.
But
he's
that
so
feels quite
counter,
risky
though.
given both, you know, Chelsea's strengths and their weaknesses. You want to put them under some pressure, don't you?
Yeah, but Pogba's really good in counter-attacking situations, though. Like, you said who else at the club can ping a pass like Twanzebe. Pogba is obviously the answer. He's, you know, well, actually, so can Fernandes, obviously. But I don't know. I think this is a really fascinating game that I have no idea how this game's going to go, because it does feel like two really top-heavy teams
going up against each other. I mean, their front three, whichever combination of players it is, or front four really, because they played 4-2-3-1 against Sevilla. Their front four is more than a match for our defensive line. I wonder if there isn't some logic to just trying to repeat the trick, because you know we shut down Di Maria, Mbappe and Neymar playing that way. Well, if you can do that, you can shut down Werner and Havertz and Pulisic, right? It's not like Chelsea have got more attacking weapons than
they've got
PSG.
Plenty of weapons, but yeah. but look, Kepa, Christiansen and Zuma, that's a massive soft underbelly. I mean,
yeah,
surely they should be thinking about like the, you know, how are they going to stop Rashford, Fernandes, Martial, Greenwood, Pogba, shouldn't they? I mean, look, I know we just praised Ollie for making a very bold change. If I was to err on the side of prediction, it would be a more cautious outlook, probably three at the back and probably very similar. You know, he does tend to, following a successful performance, follow a similar pattern. I have no data on that, but that's what I feel is true, so I'm sticking to it. So, if I was guessing, I think that's probably what he'd do. If I was selecting, you know, I know we all have recency bias, but I think I would probably, you know, try and put Chelsea under pressure. I mean, they conceded three against Southampton. You know, United can definitely cause some problems.
But I don't... There's a disconnect in the logic there, because it's not like if we play three at the back, that means we are not going to be putting their defensive line under pressure. In fact, we're very likely to put their defensive line under pressure, because we actually had quite a lot of the ball in that game, and the wing backs, particularly Tellez on the left, could, you know, really make a big impact going forward. It's just that we then have a little bit of additional stability. I'm not suggesting we park the bus against Chelsea. I'm just saying that you can play that formation without saying, okay, here you are, Chelsea, do your worst, you know.
No, sure. But at the beginning of the Paris Saint-Germain game, United did give away a lot of possession. They were behind on possession. It depends how you calculate it, right? So two ways of calculating possession: time or passes, right? So on passes, United had 39% of the possession. On time, 49% of the possession. And that was very much to do with the style of play. Not a lot of passes in this game from United. And I think it just, there's a tendency playing that way to, you know, you got to trust that you defend well. Now, we did against Paris Saint-Germain. We haven't for a lot of this season. And then do we trade off too much of the potential to put Chelsea under pressure by having more of the ball in midfield and spending more of the time in their attacking third or not, is the question.
The other question, of course, is that Martial will be out because he's still suspended.
Good point.
For his terrible violent conduct. I wonder whether we'll see Edinson Cavani play some part in this game. I imagine it seems reasonably likely that we will at least see him coming off the bench.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't. I'd be really surprised if he starts the game. He's not played a game in 8 months. You know, he can't possibly be fully match fit. He's been training at home on a running machine. So it's definitely not ideal preparation. I'm sure like 15 minutes at the end of this game or something like that. The balance, I'd forgotten that Martial is out. The balance up front will be interesting. Greenwood has missed the last couple of games. Is he fit? Is he in trouble? What's going on there?
Some talk that there's some worries about discipline.
He stand up late a few times, you know. And we do not have the same attacking depth, you know. Quality, yes, but depth, no. That may factor into it as well, because playing two attackers or three attackers makes a big difference, right? And, you know, Dan James coming into the picture or no Dan James coming into the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. If I could choose, I would choose the latter of those two. But anyway, all right, let's, having said this game is really difficult to predict and there's a load of variables, let's pick random numbers and suggest what we think the scoreline is going to be in this one.
I'm going to say 2-2.
Yeah, I was going to go for a 3-3 draw, so I'm going to stick with it. 3-3, as is the style of the times. Great.
Thanks for listening.
Three being a very important number. Aaron Wan-Bissaka knows.
Jose putting on Instagram a picture of him holding three Europa League balls with the caption, "Is this three for the three we conceded against West Ham, the three wonderful goals we scored in that game, or the two Europa Leagues I have in my pocket and the one we're going to get this season?" He needs help. Anyway,
it was lame. It was really lame.
Yeah, it was really bad. He needs PR help, I meant in that sense. Someone to write his captions for him. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back with another one of these after the weekend's game against Chelsea, and looking forward to that.
Have a good one, everyone.